New Dimension Podcast, Episode 13. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode 13, the almost kind of Halloween episode. We're mad late, and I apologize for that. It's obviously after Halloween. We've had a lot of things going on. So, without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to the show. It's Al and Don rolling in this episode, and they touch on a little bit of the topic of Halloween, and there's a couple interesting things in there. So I'm just going to let them take the stage and sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Okay.
Hello.
Yep, we're here.
This is Don and Al. We had Dallas earlier, but because of Skype, we're not able to get him. Technical difficulties. It seems to happen a lot to us.
So we're going to do the best we can without Dallas, and maybe this week we'll have... We'll all get together and do a show.
Yeah.
If we can.
Maybe another 12 episodes.
Yeah, let's just sit down and do just 12 straight episodes.
Yeah, it was kind of a bummer. Last week, Dallas, ever since he's planned out a podcast, he's wanting to do a Halloween episode. Dallas really goes for Halloween. He had all these plans. He got special sound effects. And then it just didn't work out, so we didn't do the show. And now this week, same thing. Anyway.
But we still got some stuff to talk about, so.
Well, what is it?
Well, I'm going to do my Halloween stuff.
All right, go ahead.
All right, well, I remember I talked about the creepies and eeries early on and on the first podcast anyway, and of course I mention them all the time. For this podcast, considering that the creepies and eeries and ECs were the best of the horror comics, I'm going to talk about the worst of them all, which are kind of like the ultimate guilty pleasure for me. And these were the books that were the eerie publications. Back in the 60s, even in the 70s and 80s, when you looked in the magazine rack and you saw like Vampirella and all that, they were the nice ones. These were the ones that you looked at the cover and it was like drawn by some demented artist. It looked like usually the subject matter was a monster, a vampire putting somebody in a human meat grinder or impaling somebody or eyes popping out. They were the absolute worst. Drawn and lurid, painted, I should say, in all these, real striking colors and just the craziest things you've ever seen. I remember as a kid, I never bought them, because I was just like, I was offended by it or something. I don't know. But as the years go on, your tastes change, and then you kind of like see them for what they are, like just like, gory, silly, fun. So I got a book called The Weird World of Eerie Publications. Written by Mike Howlett, somebody who I knew. I used to trade videotapes years ago. And this book's been around for a couple of years, but I decided, hey, you know what? Finally, I'm going to plunk my money down and buy it. So I did, and it is a great book. The story, basically, of Eerie Publications is kind of like the story of an artist by the name of Myron Fass, who I think he started in the late 40s. And drew a lot of horror stuff and other genres throughout the mid 50s. He basically I don't know if he drew superheroes, but by about 55, when the Comics Code cracked down on all the horror comics, everything got sanitized. The Comics Code came in. Basically, all the publishers got together from what I read in this book, and they decided, in order to, be able to survive on the newsstands, they would all form a code, and they would not use certain words like vampire or horror, terror, shock, and, basically clean it all up. Apparently, when this happened, publisher of EC, Gaines, decided he didn't want any part of it. So he ended up publishing Mad. Mad was still being published. The horror books had been canceled. So Mad became a magazine, thereby bypassing the Comics Code. And then he tried to put out these things called Pictofiction, which were like magazine-like stories using the same artists as in the Creepies and Eeries, you know, Graham Ingalls, Frazetta, George Evans, Reed Crandall, all them. And that didn't succeed, but Mad did. So Mad, you know, went on. Fast got out of the art the world and decided he wanted to start publishing magazines around this time, and he did like a Mad knockoff. I think it's called Lunaticle. only lasted like a couple of issues, but he went on and started doing other magazines. He was doing knockoffs of Monster magazines. He started doing humor magazines, girly magazines, and from what I read in this book, you know, some of them were successful, some weren't, but he didn't care. He was just like doing them and making money. You know, using people. Sometimes he would use people that worked for him for the covers. You know, make up stories. UFO magazines were being done. This went on forever. You know, this guy published, according to this book, hundreds of magazines. So at any rate, by the mid '60s, when Warren decided he was going to do the Creepy book, he put it out and it was a success. Fast decided he was going to do a knockoff of that, so he got a hold of he became partners with a gentleman named Robert Farrell, who had published horror comics in the early 50s. I think the name of the company was Ajax Farrell. You know, they were okay comics. They weren't the greatest, but you know, back then, you know, there was so many of them that they sold well, and you know, they went on doing them until, again, the Comics Code thing and the Seduction of the Innocent book came out, and the comics got cleaned up. So at any rate, Fast grabbed a hold of the art, got in partnership with Farrell, started using the old stories, and then got Carl Burgos, who was the creator of the Human Torch, a Golden Age artist, and he got him as the art director. And they basically did a knockoff of Creepy with, like, reprints. The cover was like a big Frankenstein. You saw it, Don. Big Frankenstein, yeah, monster. Yeah. And then the insides were just old reprints. One of the things they did was they got the production artist to make them a little bloodier and gorier because they figured it would sell better that way. So they would add blood and whatever to it to make it look more, you know, more scarier or whatever. And then they would do, like, gray tones to give it, like, a more of a look like the Warren books, which some of the artists were using gray tones and, you know, techniques like that. I mean, it didn't really, it was nowhere near as good, but apparently it sold. Steve Bissett wrote a foreword, and he bought the first issue, and he talks about, like, once you buy one, you're cursed because it's like, it's like, you know, such a guilty pleasure. So at any rate, they put out that weird, it's called Weird, came out for a few issues, I think 6 or 7 issues. And then, like, as the year, by 67, I think it was, he jumped in and put out 4 different books. I think it was Witch's Tales. I got them right here. Let me see if I can... Actually, he put out a book called Tales from the Crypt, and got sued afterwards by William Gaines because he, you know, you can't put out a book called Tales from the right. Crypt because he owned the rights to them at any rate. So he decided to he canceled that, and he put out, okay, here they are, the 4 titles. 68, I think it was, Horror Tales, Terror Tales, Tales from the Tomb, and Witch's Tales. They're all reprint from old stories, published like 6 titles a month, I think it was, and they sold by around 69. they were kind of running out of stories, so they started to do new stories, and they brought in some American artists, Dick Ayers, Chick Stone, Larry Warme, and then they brought in some artists from Argentina as well. But the deal was that these new stories that were done were basically just the old stories redrawn, so they were just totally recycled stuff, but you know, they told the guys, hey, make them even gorier. So, yeah, they made them even gorier, but it was the same old stories. Again, you know, people would buy these things for the cover and then read them and then go like, oh, yeah, it's great, you know, buy one issue maybe, whatever. I don't know how big of a fan base they had that bought every issue, but, you know, they sold for the guy and they were, you know, and they were doing good. So these books went on through, the mid-70s, the main selling point of these books were the covers, because they were totally gross and disgusting. Artists like Chick Stone did some covers. Bob Powell did some early ones. Who else did some? Burgos did a lot of them. And a guy called Larry Alexander, who was kind of like a girly mag cover artist, but he was part of the... You know, the Erie, I think it was called Countryside Publications, which is Myron Fass's company. He was part of the company, so of course he did the covers for these. Again, reprinting stuff over and over again, gorier and gorier. And then, you know, by like 75, the Marvel, by 73, I think, Marvel had started getting in on the game. And they started publishing their own horror magazines, Vampire Tales, Haunt of Horror, Monsters Unleashed, and basically they were glutting the market, because you got the Warren books, you had the Erie publications, you had another company called Skywald that was doing new stories that was kind of like, it was almost on par with Warren, but not as good, and then you get Marvel getting in on, so there was like a glut of horror books, and kind of like in 75, according to the book, the thing just tanked, it died. Most of the companies quit, except for Warren, who continued, you know, doing their thing, because they were the best ones up until, like, the early 80s. So by 75, these Erie publications stopped. I guess in 76, they began again, because you can't keep, like, you know, you can't keep them down or whatever. Again, reprinting, more titles, but this time I think they had less titles. I think they came out with two new titles called Vampire Tales and Terrors of Dracula. They got different cover artists. Some of the Spanish cover artists were doing them, and they looked. The covers were a little more along the lines of the creepy and eerie. They're a little more sophisticated. They were less, like crazy and gross. But you know, again, they were just reprinting the same old story. So basically, they died after that. And then somehow or another, They started putting out reprint books, but then they decided instead of putting them out as just like 60 pages, they put them out as 100 pages. Again, this guy, all he would do is just redo the covers. Actually, from what I read in the book, they would pick an original cover that they did back in the 60s, get Carl Berger or somebody else to repaint it or paste up another monster over it and just try to make it look like a different cover. This is just a total, like, you know, low budget, kind of like the old horror movies from that day. Low budget, gore, you know, cheapo production. And everybody hated them. I mean, most of the people hated them, but now they're big collector's items because they're so, like, crazy. So, and I will post some, we'll be posting some covers on the blog so you'll see them. But, yeah, and I like I said, about 10 years ago, I came across, like, a bunch of them at a bookstore, and it was like, wow, it was like a buck a piece, so I had to get them, you know, and I've been hooked on these things since, so, you know, Erie Publications, you rule, man, I love these books,
right.
You'll see them.
I never had any of those when I was a kid. I remember seeing some of the stuff on the stands.
Yep.
The ones he showed me in the magazine, or the book, wow, kind of fascinated me. They're certainly of the time. They mostly had that 60s look. And it had a funness, even though there's a lot of gore and stuff like that. It was
Yes.
It was a lighthearted, fun thing. It reminded me a lot of, remember Rat Fink by Ed Roth?
Yes, yes.
And when I was a little kid, they used to have bubblegum stickers. You buy them in packs like trading cards of Odd Rods. It was always, you right. know, those Rat Fink type characters that are always monsters with the bug eyes driving supercars, you know, muscle cars. And, you know, when I saw these magazines, that's exactly what it reminded me of. And the book is a good example because it's showing what Al's talking about, where it has how it was originally and how they brought it back and added more gore to it. But nevertheless, it was still great fun.
Yeah, that was that is that. They were fun. They were kind of like they weren't. They were drawn in such a cartoony style that you couldn't take them too seriously. But you know, it was pretty grim for what they were doing. You know, it was just like, wow, really? You're doing that? And then, and back then, it was kind of shocking to see that in a comic book. Now, I mean, nowadays, yeah. It's like, no big deal, but it was pretty graphic stuff. And on the inside, it was just like, yeah, I always wondered, man, who are these artists? I mean, they suck, you know? I mean, the Spanish guys over in Warren and Kaluta and Jones and Wrightson, who are these guys? It turns out they were like early 50s comic book artists, and they're not the greatest. You know, they're okay. You know, now I see them in a different light now. And of course, Dick Ayers did some crazy stuff, and you know, Stone did some crazy stuff, and I don't know. It's hard to explain. You'll see examples of it. It's just crazy. Crazy comics from the past that probably wouldn't get published today. Only as reprints, and only for like certain, you know, for a small, you know, a group of people. That these things wouldn't sell in today's comic book market. But it's crazy stuff, man. The 60s, it's crazy stuff. You think you saw it all, and you see some of this stuff, and you go, wow. So I'm just waiting to like go. Look through some old comic books and see if I can find even more strange, because I'm pretty sure there's even more smaller companies out there that I haven't even didn't even know about. Because you remember, Don, back then when you used to go to the comic rack, there were like three racks of comics, and you looked at the magazine rack and it was full of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There you could never ever see everything that was going on.
Right, so, yeah. Grocery stores, everybody had magazines. It was major.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all vastly different.
Oh, yeah. And this guy Fast was publishing, like, he was publishing the Erie publications. He would be doing books, like, whatever was big. Like, I say, the Beatles, hey, he did a book. It shows a cover over here called the Dave Clark Five Versus the Beatles. Like, a whole magazine.
Yeah.
And he would do, like, a UFO magazine when UFOs were big. A lot of these. You probably remember these. You'd go to the stands and see, like, Star Wars, you know, classics or whatever. And it was just a book on Star Wars. And, again, it was just a quick knockoff thing by Fast just to make a quick buck. You know, one issue, and that was it. You know, he made his money, and that was it. Somewhere along the line, he got sued by I think one of the printers or somebody he worked with, and he ended up moving from Jersey, where he was, to Ocala, Florida, believe it or not. And he started publishing like gun magazines and anything. And he died like a few years ago, so I think he was publishing mags up until the end. But this guy was he was definitely like you know, guys like Herschel Gordon Lewis and
that's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah, the exploitation guys from the 60s, the movie makers like Herschel Gordon Lewis or people like that. He was definitely like the magazine version of this.
You know, speaking of Herschel Gordon Lewis, a mutual friend of ours, Mark Aginola, he does special effects, you know, makeup, dead bodies, zombie makeup. We worked with this guy for several years. He's very quiet, keeps to himself. One time, somebody at work brought in little tiny tubs of Play-Doh, gave it, you know, passed it around. And it's kind of interesting because some people would make something out of it and let it dry and keep on their computer. Somebody made one of the heads on Easter Island. Somebody made a little holder for their keyboard with it. And Mark had made a human finger had a green Play-Doh, but you can see the fingernail, you can see all the lines, and then at the very end of the finger, you can see where it's cut off and all the skin is hanging out, and it had a bone in the middle. I couldn't believe it. I said, how did you make this? Well, that's when I found out he did the special effects makeup. And he ended up working on a film with called The Uh-Oh Show by Herschel Gordon Lewis, who I had never heard of. And then because of that, you know, we got to talk, and he started bringing in, because I guess he had a DVD of the making of The Uh-Oh Show. And they showed all the actors and, you know, people behind it and the special effects people. And there was people walking around asking Herschel Gordon Lewis to sign their DVDs. Well, he's got more? That's when to me, it was an underground I've never heard of. I've heard the guy on podcasts since. Mark had lent me a movie with a DVD with three of his movies on it, done in the 60s. My plan was, there's one Sunday, I was just going to, you know, watch one and then give it back to him and say, I watched it. I watched all three in a row, and I had a blast. I mean, they're low-budget films, and, you know, again, they're from the 60s. But, and even though, I mean, it's talking about, you know, decapitation and horrifying things.
Oh, man, those are the goriest.
But,
oh, my God.
But again, it was great fun. The one I enjoyed the most was these people ended up, they were driving out in the middle of nowhere and got lost, and they went for directions, ended up being at some carnival, and two groups of people, and basically the carnival was, the townspeople were killing them.
Oh, 2,000 maniacs.
Yeah. It was,
2,000 maniacs.
It was, man, it was so much fun. And when I'm saying this, I'm laughing. It was horrifying, but.
That one is better than the other two, actually. That has a better story than the.
Yeah, the other one was about people getting buried on the beach, and I forgot what the first one was.
Well, the first one was what's it called? Blood Feud?
Yeah, Blood Feud.
Yeah, that's the one where the Egyptian guy comes back, yeah. And he's like pulling like tongues of women to make a sacrifice for the ancient god. You know the funny thing about it? That thing was filmed in Miami.
Well, he lives in Florida.
He lives in Florida. Yeah, he lives in South Florida. But Blood Feud was filmed in Miami, and the hotel was called the Suez, and it was right on Miami Beach. It was like, okay, I know where that is. I may have stayed at that hotel. I don't know, but I kind of missed all this hijinks going on, but. Oh, yeah, those H.G. Lewis movies are nuts.
Yeah, he's
totally, totally nuts.
He's really interesting to listen to as well. I love to hear him talk. Mark had told me, I guess he's a marketing genius. You know,
yes, he is.
He works in advertising. That's where he makes his money. The DVD also had commentary, which I love getting movies and listening to commentary. And I didn't get to listen to all of them because I ran out of time. But he's just such a vibrant person, you know.
Did I say Blood Feud? It's Blood Feast.
Okay, well, it's close enough.
Blood Feast is a better title.
But that's one thing he was talking about. I guess originally him and another guy were doing beach bunny movies. I guess that's what they call them.
Nudie cuties.
Were they nudie cuties? And he was talking about to him they were fun, and that was his idea of porn. And
yep.
All of a sudden, the porn industry, I guess, changed to what it became, and that's not what he wanted to do, so he started doing the horror flicks. But,
oh, yeah.
But just the way he talks, it's fun. He's always saying, we decided to do movies that Hollywood couldn't do, or he says, wouldn't do, or couldn't do.
That's right.
So,
well, the thing about the nudie ones, that was, I think that was kind of started by Russ Meyer. He did some of those, and they saw how much money they were making, and Herschel got connected with a guy called David Friedman, and they did. I think they did some. They did some up in Chicago, but then they came down to Florida to do the nudist colony films, and that's where a lot of those nudie cutie things came out. And yeah, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. Once the movie started becoming really explicit, these guys decided they didn't want to get into that. So they just went into explicit gore. You know, and the thing about the blood feast and all those things back then was like in the early 60s, mid-60s when it came out, they would play drive-ins without ratings. So people would be going to these drive-ins and going like, oh, this looks like good. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God, what the hell is going on here?
They were fun. Show Mark Lent to me. It's a really good movie and it's really clever, but that one, I mean, it's fun, it's over the top, you know, and it's, you know, but still, when they were showing all the stuff, all my stomach was knotting up. I watched it.
Yeah, man.
It, again, it was just great, great fun, but yeah, it was, it was
rough. Is the Uh-Oh Show just as gory as those early ones?
Well, a little more. The Uh-Oh Show was basically a game show, and the contestants would go up, and you'd have to answer these questions. And everybody get the first one, and then after that, you know, they spin the wheel, you know, and show what you could win or what would happen to you. And they'd always miss the second one, and they'd lose an arm. They'd cut the arm off. And what was clever about it was it showed all the people in the audience, and they had these saw blades, like from a table saw. They had a saw blade. It was a little hat, and a piece of cardboard was embedded in their head. And then when the person missed the question, the audience screams, uh-oh, and then they all pick up plastic sheets that's laying in front of them to cover themselves, and then, you know, the blood splatters everywhere. And, you know, and then they'll continue on missing an arm, and they'll lose a leg or, you know, they're trying to get higher to win $1 million or, you know, whatever. But, I mean, the whole thing was done over the top. When I gave it back to Mark, I said, that knotted my stomach. And he said, well, it was just all fun, which it is. It's all tongue-in-cheek, and it was all fun. It's still horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't know what you're getting into, it just kind of gets nauseating after a while. Now, did he do the blood effects, the gore?
Yeah, he did some of them. One of the characters ended up getting a saw blade embedded in his head, and Mark had done that. And they had an ancient storybook, like an antique storybook, that Herschel Gordon Lewis, he's in the movie, he was reading from. And Mark had done that. And there was a few other things.
Was it filmed here in Clearwater? Here?
Well, somewhere. It was here in Florida. I don't think it was real far away.
Okay. I didn't know.
It's gotten him work with other movies. Mark did a lot of work on a movie called Brainjacked, which was really pretty good. And then they just finished another one called Psycho Dish. And that one, it was amazing. I've seen pictures. Mark was doing whole body parts and stuff. It looks real. And butchered body parts. But the guy that's, I don't know the movie. I've never seen it. I've seen pictures. But there's a guy, I think he's called Kevin. But he's a heavy guy. He's just got, again, kind of Rat Fink looking facial expressions. But it shows him eating these body parts, you know. And I guess the movie's about him killing people and eating them. But he's very expressive. He's amazing. But Mark said, I guess that when they released the movie and were showing it, you know, in a couple of theaters down in Sarasota, they said people were leaving in packs of 10s and 20s.
Oh, my.
And I couldn't do it. I said, I don't think I'd be one of them. And then after I watched the Uh-Oh Show, he said, well, I don't think you can handle the Psycho Dish. But as far as Mark's work, it's the pictures I've seen, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, you know who else does local horror movies here in Florida? Nicola Cuddy.
Yeah. He's the guy, for people don't know, he's a writer. He was an assistant for Wally Wood. He's also an artist. But I've always known him as a writer. He was the co-creator of E-Man for Charlton Comics.
Right.
And as a kid, I always loved those stories him and Joe Staten did. He wrote a lot of different stories. He also wrote the Raj 2000 stories that John Byrne drew for Charlton.
Right.
And I've seen his name. He had a series of stuff in heavy metal, one-page stories. He wrote Andrew. But yeah, I got to meet him. here in Florida a couple of times. One at Pat's store on Free Comic Day. Really interesting person.
Yeah, that's right. That's when I met him too. Yeah, he actually got his start in Warren doing short stories, and I think he became an editor there for a little while, but then he freelanced the whole time. And I think I read somewhere where he actually did all that stuff because he really didn't like superheroes that much.
Yeah. So
he kind of like was doing the short stories and the. And even though E-Man was superheroes, kind of like a takeoff on superheroes too. So, but yeah, he's got a new movie, and I can't remember on my memory, but it's at Comics World, and I'll get the artwork for it and put it on the blog. But yeah, he's another one who does local stuff.
Well,
and I don't think Mark Anginola worked with him, did he?
Not that I know of. Yeah, we're still young. Maybe he will.
Yeah.
No,
the guy who did Brainjacked, his name is Joel Wynkoop, I think.
I didn't know. When they premiered Joel the movie, Wynkoop. They did it at the Clearwater Cinema Cafe. And it was at midnight. And, you know, on a Saturday night, I ended up going. My daughter wanted to go, and she brought two of her friends. And they were all in high school. And that place is packed. They had to get extra chairs for us. And that was just so much fun, you know, watching it there with all these people, and you know, a lot of them were people that worked on the film. And it was just, you could cut the excitement with a knife. There was one part in the scene where this kid, you know, he was brain-jacked, and he wakes up in the morning, and he's looking in the mirror in the bathroom, and he has a little tiny spot on his forehead. You know, it looked like somebody drilled a hole in his head, and there's just a little bit of dry blood there. And he stopped and looked, and there's a close-up, and everybody in the theater, ooh, which, you know, it looked real. And then somebody sitting over by me says, oh, nice job, Mark. Which, you know, it was exciting when you're talking about your friend, you know, and you'd see some of the, he did quite a bit of work on that. But it's a fun movie, and it shows off, you know, St. Petersburg and Clearwater area. The pier, St. Petersburg Pier is in it.
Oh, cool.
But it was a fun movie. Here's a funny one. When we left, my daughter's friends, after we left the theater, they were just going, that was so bad! And they were laughing. And, you know, I listened to we were driving home, and my daughter was a little put out about it, you know, that they were acting that way. But I said, well, you know, you got to understand, it was, you know, done by local people. But, I went because, you know, Mark's a friend of mine. I wanted to see it, but I really enjoyed myself. I thought it was a neat story. I liked all the things to it. I really had a good time. But what's funny was that's all her friends talked about. They kept wanting to see it again. They kept telling everybody about it. So it has a charm. There's a funness to it.
Yeah, kind of like these eerie publication books. They are gross and badly, well, I wouldn't say badly drawn, but not the best drawing, but they do have a charm to them that's kind of like a lost thing, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I always make...
You won't see anything like this being made today, on purpose even.
Yeah.
I'm surprised Alan Moore hasn't tried to do something like this, but I guess he's even this is too low for him, you know? I mean, he did the 63 books, which were kind of like a takeoff on the early Marvels, but I don't think anybody wants to get near these. Not yet, anyway.
You know, those 1963 books, they were all neat. I thought the characters created were neat, and artwork, and it did have that old Marvel feel, but to me, what made that really special was all the ads in it. Because they made up their own ads, and it was like the stuff you used to see in the, you know, 60s and part of the 70s, where one page would just be a whole bunch of different little boxes, you know, with little logos and stuff, and tell you send off a dollar, you can get this and that. And
right.
They wrote all their ads, and one of them that kind of caught me was they had the Mad Love logo, you know, Alan Moore's publishing company, and Spider Baby Graphics, which I guess was Steve Bissett or John Tottlebins. And then
right.
And then another one Rick Veach had. You know, he had three logos in there. The ad was for, send them a dollar, and they'll send you stickers for all the defunct comics publishers. And, but I thought, man, I mean, they just put so much work on all the ad pages, and you know, they had a letters bullpen page, you know, like Stan Lee would do. And I mean, it was just a fun package. I really enjoyed those.
Oh, I did too. I thought that was a great idea, and Alan Moore did a great job, and you know, in coming up with the fun aspect of the goofy superheroes of the time. Yeah, I mean, definitely, it was a whole package. It wasn't just the stories and the Kirby-ish art or whatever. It was actually, like you said, the ads and the letters page and all that.
Yeah, they were fun. Well, it's about time, I guess, for music break.
Hey, folks. Right here, we were supposed to have a different band. It was going to be Don's brother, but we had a little bit of difficulty. Something fell through, so we're going to play them in the future. So for tonight, this is an old band I was in called Realize, and this is our rendition of an old Depeche Mode song. So enjoy.
Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Yeah, really. We've gone all throughout all the Halloween stuff. So what else have you been reading these days?
Well, Dallas, you know, we were talking about favorite artist. He was talking about Frank Quietly, and I kind of butchered it and said he reminded me of Ernie Colon, and I realized I was talking about Jeff Loeb. So Dallas, again, took it upon himself and gave me a collection of Superman that I guess Grant Morrison wrote and Frank Quietly drew. And so that's what I've been reading. They're actually really good. It's Superman, but the stories are pretty unique, and the artwork, it's very good. He's really good. He reminds me, I was telling Al earlier, he reminds me of Michael Kaluta on how he draws figures and how he would actually set figures up in panels. He's his own person, but it has that flavor. He doesn't put as much as Mike LaPluta were doing his, but I'm kind of surprised the guy's able to do this much work month after month.
So, this is a recent book?
No, recent to me. But I think this came out about 5-6 years ago.
Oh, he's been working for that long, okay.
Well, Dallas also has an X-Men book. I don't know why it was called, Astonishing X-Men or something. But he has the trade, I've read that, it's good. That one had a different feel. The inker was different, I imagine. But Dallas just loves them. The stories were good, but these Supermans, they're actually really unique. He's got everything that we remember from the 50s that Superman had. You know, Jimmy Olsen's the crazy reporter, you know. They have one panel where he's dressing up like a woman. You know, he used to do that all the time. And they have this Superman's Fortress of Solitude, you know, with the Bottle City of Kandor, which I always loved. It has Superman robots in it. You know, it has that feel, but it's all modern. But the stories are actually unique. Basically what it was, Superman's got some kind of cancer. He's dying. And he's trying to figure out a way to stop it. I haven't finished the 12th issue. Dallas is missing about 3 issues of the series. So, but each one's...
Who's the writer?
Grant Morrison.
Oh, okay.
I don't really remember ever reading any of his books. I know he's famous. But they're pretty neat stories. Each one's a self-contained story, but if you read them all together, you know, it builds a series.
So it was a mini-series?
Well, it was 12 issues.
But was it within the Superman numbering, or was it a separate?
No, they're separate. I don't know if the book continued on without the creative team or whatnot. See, okay. That would have been a plus if Dallas was on the show, because he would have told us more about it.
Well, he will next time.
Yeah, but it's actually really good. It's worth reading.
Okay. Well, Morrison was famous for his Doom Patrols, I guess, back in the day.
Well, is he the one that also wrote Animal Man in the 80s?
He's the guy who wrote Animal Man, yeah.
Yeah, again, I never read those. I remember seeing them in the stores. I always liked the Brian Boland covers.
Oh, yeah.
And, but I never read it, but I know that was a big talk. Every time you go in the store, people talk about it. You know, you hear people talk about it to this day. And
well, Animal Man's back. I haven't read the new issue, but he's back. I think Dallas was talking about wanting to read. I'm not sure if he has or not. Did you?
No, I've never read them. The only Animal Man comics I ever read was reprints from the 60s.
Well, those are Carmen Infantino ones?
Yeah, which I love.
Yeah, they are a lot of fun.
But I've never read anything since he's been back, so.
Was it with you were you and me the ones who were talking about how there was some original art for sale, and they said some of the most expensive pages are the Carmen Infantino pages from back then. Was I talking to you about that?
No, it's new to me, but I wouldn't be surprised. I loved him.
Oh, I did too, but I was really surprised that he was fetching such high prices, you know, because, I mean, as much as I loved him, there was other people that I, you know, kind of liked better, and I always held in highest esteem, but apparently, like, the Infantino pages are, like, you know, heavy-duty bucks. I'm kind of surprised, but yeah, the early Flash stuff and all that, that's all classic Silver Age, so...
Yeah, no, I don't know about that. And there were other artists I liked better, but he was one of my favorites at the time. I guess he didn't draw so much when he was the editor, the publisher of DC Comics. What do they call him?
He was the editor, the big
kahuna.
Well, he's the one who brought Kirby over.
Yeah, he brought Kirby over, and he was the one. They always talked about at DC was the artist editors. All the editors they had at Disney at DC in the early 70s were artists that became editors.
Well, who were the other ones? I'm drawing a blank on.
Well,
Orlando.
Yeah, Joe Orlando was one I was thinking of. Well, I know Julius Swartz was still an editor.
Well, yeah, Julius Forge in there, but he wasn't an artist, was he?
No, he was not. But was one of them. But yeah. I wonder who took over the Superman books. Because Mort Weisner was gone.
I don't even remember.
See, we didn't research anything. I'm just talking out of my hat. But I do know they always talked about as artist editors. Well, I guess...
Well, I know definitely Orlando. He did a lot of the books.
Yeah, he certainly did. And
Giordano. Giordano would be another one. Dick Giordano.
Okay. Well, Jack Kirby was his own editor.
Even though, you remember, like, they would always do a paste-up over some of his Superman drawings and Jimmy Olsen drawings, because they...
Yeah.
Whoever the editor was didn't like Kirby's rendition of those characters. So.
Well, I think they had three different editors for the Superman books. You know, it wasn't like all the Superman, you know, Mort Weisner, when he was editor, he had everything Superman was under him. And then the other guy had all the Batman stuff under him. And when Julius Schwartz took over, you know, Mort Weisner retired. And there was three different people, you know, that had each book, edited each book.
I'm pretty sure Orlando did all the horror comics.
Yeah,
the House of Mystery and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's another thing, talking about the horror. I know in the 70s, that's one thing a lot of friends of mine would say was DC had a really good line of horror books. They were quite popular, and that's where Bernie Wrightson did so many covers. But I used to pick those up once in a while. They ran those all the way up to the 80s, I think.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, sure. House of Mystery, House of Secrets, and they would have all the ones that were the ghosts, and the Sinister House of... what was it called? The Sinister House of Haunted Tales or something. That was kind of like a gothic... one that had all the it had some beautiful Toll stories in it, that's for sure. A couple of them have Jeff Jones covers, but yeah. You know who was Joe Kubert was an editor too, I think.
Yeah.
Around that time.
Well, he edited all the war titles, I know, and I guess the Tarzan stuff and everything.
Yeah, him, Giordano. God, let me try. Now I'm trying to think. Now, I mean, obviously. Joe Orlando did all of the ones. Okay, but at any rate, yeah. At any rate, yeah. Yeah, those DC horror books were nice. I mean, especially like in the early 70s when they had Neil Adams doing stories and Gil Kane would do stories and Toth was doing like a lot of the Witching Hour stories. And,
yeah, I really liked those.
Oh, man, yeah. Early Wrightson. Kaluta. Actually, a Swamp Thing was a short story in one of the House of Secrets or House of Mystery.
Right.
And then it became, you know, its own book from that.
Yeah, it was just supposed to be a small 6-page story, and then people liked it so much and wrote in that they decided to give its own series.
Oh yeah, that. And I remember buying it at a flea market, and I was like, "Wow, this cover was cool." And I saw it was Wrights, and I was like, "Oh man, pretty
yeah.
neat."
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, we have the cover on on the blog on the it's either the second or third episode of the show. But you know who the woman is on the cover?
With is that the wife?
Yeah, it was. Louise Jones, which was...
Well, that's Louise Jones? Okay.
That was Bernie Wrightson's friend, Jeff Jones, you know, one of the studio guys. That was his wife, who ended up becoming Louise Simonson.
And if and here's another one. If you read the first Swamp Thing story, the one of the characters in it that he draws, the guy with the mustache, is Mike Kaluta. I could tell. I never read it before, but I could tell because I'd seen pictures of him and he drew him just to look exactly like Kaluta. So I was like, okay, that's kind of neat. All right. But yeah, Louise Jones was married to Jeff Jones at the time when they all moved to New York City. And they all, him and Wrightson and Kaluta and I think some other guy, Steve Hickman, was another one. They all were friends, and they all were chummy, and they were all the new guys, and, you know, they were the new blood, you know, the new artists from D.C., and they were all doing the horror stories, and they were all great. At a certain point, some of those books kind of became... some of the artists left because of... I guess, the studio guys left and they're doing posters and their own thing. And then they would just get... that's when the influx of the Filipino artists came in. So you'd see a lot of Alfred Alcala stories and Tony DeZuniga stories and... what are the other guys? Nestor Redondo did more of the war books. The war books or the jungle books, the Tarzan books he did. But, yeah, around that time when those guys went on, they had the Filipino artists. And those were all fun, man. They were very good. I really liked them a lot.
Yeah, well, Filipinos, the Philippine comics, and they have a lot of horror. That's a real popular thing. Horror, zombies. Zombies were huge. Vampires.
Sure.
But any of the black magic stuff, they liked it. So I can understand why a lot of the Filipino artists that came over here would jump into that.
Yeah, they were basically doing a lot of the short story stuff. And then, they went on. And those guys were prolific, too, because Alcala was... He was inking Conan, doing a horror story. He even did humor stories for that Plop magazine. Remember that, DC Plop
magazine? Oh, yeah,
He even did stuff like that, so it was just, amazing. DeZuniga was the same thing. He was doing the horror stories. Jonah Hex, he ended up working for Marvel, inking some of the black and white books. I mean, those guys were amazing. Back then, I think the story was that some of the artists, the American artists, like Neil Adams, was trying to get them to form, a union. And I think DC ended up, going to the Philippines and hiring a bunch of a studio artist there to do all their books, so they could basically break whatever union was trying to be formed by Neil Adams. So it was kind of a weird. So I mean, there was a podcast that you gave me once that was talking about that, right, Don?
I think so. I don't really remember offhand what it was, but
right.
Yeah, I just remember when all those artists popped up. Of course, I didn't know they were from the Philippines. I found out later, and it's kind of a funny story. I was a huge George Perez fan. And there was, he was doing a bunch of comics at Marvel. He was drawing Fantastic Four, drawing Avengers. He did short pieces, an Inhumans title. He did four issues of Logan's Run movie adaptation.
Man-Wolf.
Oh, yeah, those two Man-Wolf stories. I loved him. And then all of a sudden, he just disappeared. And I was in the comic store asking the guy, what happened to George Perez? And the guy said, well, it's probably because of the mail and the distance. He's one of the Filipino artists. Really? And he said, well, the name like Perez, of course, he'd be one. And this is probably just lost in the mail. Well, kind of found it wasn't true. He wasn't Filipino. I think he was Puerto Rican, but, he was here in New York, or in New York. And that's when I started hearing about the Filipino artist. I read the history about it, In the Philippines, comics are huge. I was kind of surprised when I went there. You'd see people on the streets, even old people, just sitting there reading a comic book. It's not like here where it was considered kids' things. Everywhere you went, you'd see a comic laying around somewhere on a table, and somebody would just sit down and read it. It didn't matter how old they were or, what they did. But most of the stuff was either romance stories or horror stories. They didn't really have any superhero. They had some fantasy stuff for kids. But it was always kind of sometimes a dark horror type thing.
Right, and that fit in perfectly with the DC books.
Yeah. But that was a criticism. Reading about the history of the Filipino comics, they spell it with a K. It's called comics, But
Pinoy comics.
Yeah, Pinoy comics. But they pronounce their vowels different. But the Comics Journal ran a whole history of it. What amazed me, the reason the comics industry appeared there was everybody knows in World War II, American soldiers had comic books. That's when the American comic industry just hit the roof. They were selling, tons of comics in the millions. And it was after the war, when everybody came back, that's when comics, cold and superhero comics, kind of disappeared, and it all went to westerns and horror and stuff, crime comics. But anyway, in the Philippines, you know, the soldiers have some back, you know, comics in their backpack, and after they read them, they just leave them laying around somewhere, and the Filipinos would get hold of them. And that's when they started doing their own. But they were huge. They were everywhere. My wife has a collection. They're
done. You really? I didn't know.
Yeah, that's well, nice. I had a couple I bought over there, and just to have. You know, wherever I went, I always tried to buy a can of Coke and a comic book, local, and a tape, and a music tape. But I had a few, and then when my wife first came to the United States, you know, she, you know, you always get homesick for home. And she wrote one of her sisters, and she sent her a package of videotapes of Filipino movies and TV shows. And she's got a drawer full of the comics. And
nice.
Still has them. Most of them, the newsprint was really cheap newsprint. Almost, I hate to say it, but it's almost like toilet paper. And the covers are made of the same paper. Some of them were color all the way through, but usually had one story that was kind of black and white or two color. But the covers had more vibrant color on them, but they were always the light paper too. But they were pretty neat, pretty fun. You know.
Yeah, I didn't know that their comic industry started after World War II, because they had a film industry that was from like silent era, because a friend of mine, Brian Yetter, put out a book, History of Cinema in the Philippines, and he basically talked about their film industry, and they were around the same time as our film industry was.
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody had the film industry and recording industries. The comic book is an American art form.
That's what I was trying to tell one of our coworkers, that the comic book was an American art form, and he was basically saying that, well, no, because there was newspaper strips in other countries, and there was, like, editorial things. I go, yeah, but the first time that all stories got put into a book sold this way was in America.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was right. Okay.
Yeah, from what I'm told, until we find out something different, but that's where I think all the other countries is after World War II. Everywhere the United States had been, they left comic books. And from what I'm told, that's where the French industry built up from, and the Japanese manga all came out of that. Of course, they're all different. You know, the French comics, to me, are the top of the pile. And they're treated like an art form over there. I love the albums. You know, Mobius, J.C. Mezières, you know, what's that other guy? Anki Bilal. Just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
One other European cartoonist. But, their industries were different. They didn't have the... I'm guessing maybe they had floppies in the beginning, the little pamphlets like we have, the standard 22-page comic, but, you know, what they do now is they run them in magazines, and then they publish them on albums after they're finished, which is really nice.
Well, yeah, the Spanish obviously had their industry, because those are the guys that ended up working for Creepy and Eerie. They weren't the Filipinos. The Filipinos, from what I remember reading, went mostly for Marvel and DC's, and the Spanish guys went to... black and white books, the horror books, the Skywald and Warren, and the guys that Erie did, there was some Argentine artists. So each country had a different you know, foreign country that they were using. I think if I remember correctly, they were using studios. Like, there was a studio in Spain where Esteban Morodo and all those guys came from, and there was a studio in Argentina where some of the guy came from. And I think there was a studio in the Philippines, where, like, Dizaninga and Alcala and Redondo and all those guys came. So they would just license the studios to do their stories, and those guys really, you know, did a lot of work.
Well, eventually,
You know what's funny, too? The guy that's always been lumped with the Filipinos, I can't think of his name now. I'm going to blank.
Think of it. Well, a lot of those Filipinos
There's one of the guys that isn't a Filipino that you'd be surprised who he was. And it's, I'll remember it as we keep talking. I'm like drawing a blank on it right now.
Well, none of those.
Pablo Marcos.
Oh, yeah. No, I never thought he was a. He's a Filipino?
He's not a Filipino. Oh. He's from Peru.
Yeah, I never.
A name like Marcos, you would.
Oh, yeah. No, I never thought he was, because he just always had that smooth style. The Filipinos,
yeah.
You know, they have a. Even though each Filipino artist is vastly different than the other one, they always have that. Almost woodcut rendered style with a lot of curly lines.
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
You know, I mean, Pablo Marcos, he always had that smooth Joe Sennett style.
But Dizaninga didn't really have that woodcut style. He was kind of a sketcher kind
yeah,
of guy.
No.
Thought.
Yeah, you're right. He was slightly different.
But you're talking about the Redondos and the Alcalas and people like
yeah,
that.
And yeah, and my favorite, Alex Nino.
Oh, well, he's just a great crazy artist. Yeah,
he's something. But a lot of those Filipino artists end up coming here to the United States.
Did they move here?
Yeah, I know Alcala, I think, was in California.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I know Alex Dino was in Chicago, somewhere around there. But I think most of those guys ended up, after a while, coming over here to the United States and just, you know, living here. But that was a criticism in that Comics Journal book. The Filipino comics industry, their top artists came here to the United States. And I don't think that's true anymore, but, you know, like I said, they had a lot of prolific artists. The Filipino comics came out every week. They were weekly.
Okay.
And they were always, I guess each, you know, the titles were thin, like an American comic book, but they were weekly, and they were like an anthology, kind of like DC's House of Secrets or House of Mystery. I remember one of my brother-in-laws was complaining about it, that he'd read one comic because he liked one story, but he didn't like the other two. Well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know,
all right.
Well, you know.
And there was I had one Pinoy comics. I can't remember who the artists were, but yeah, it was great. The art was fine. Oh, another guy, that Jesse Santos, the guy who did Dr. Spectre. He's another fantastic artist from the Philippines. I don't know if he moved here or not, but he mostly worked for Gold Key.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny how some of those guys just work for certain companies. He mostly did his work for Gold Key, but he's another fantastic guy whose work I really loved a lot. So, and he was from the Philippines, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, they're really nice, really strong.
So anyway, man. So, did we get into what you're reading, or?
Well, I just brought up the Superman. I guess the only other thing I can say, and again, it's because of Dallas. I've always heard of 100 Bullets. I've never read it, and I don't really remember why. But years ago, Dallas mentioned it, so he brought in the first trade, and I read it. I really enjoyed it. I love the story. I love the art. The art wasn't something that. You know, everybody has a certain artist that as soon as they see, they like it and buy it for that, regardless of the story. And this one, I really liked the artist in it, but it wasn't the type that I would have bought sight unseen, you know. But reading the story, I just thought, this is perfect. I love how the guy composed, how he laid things out, and the drawing style itself. And I brought it back to Dallas and said, this is really good, I think I'm going to get it. And so you can have it. He said he liked it, but he just didn't like it enough. And I've been picking these trades up ever since. Fantastic work.
Who's the artist?
Hang on. I've got it right here. Eduardo Rizzo.
Okay.
The writer is Brian Azzarillo. And artist is Eduardo Rizzo. I've heard on another podcast, I think what they originally did was they did 100 issues, you know, standard American comic book. And it was those two men stayed on it the whole time. It was their project. And then once the 100 issues finished, that was it. They've been putting the 13 trades, which is how I've been getting it. It's pretty interesting. I still don't really know exactly how it's going on. The story starts.
Is it, Is it a crime book or an action book?
I guess you call it a crime book. It starts out in a women's prison. And there's this girl with a teardrop tattoo on her, under her left eye. And she's getting out of prison that day. Nobody picks her up, and this guy shows up. And long story short, he gives her a briefcase that has a gun. And the gun has 100 bullets in it. And he said, these are untraceable, no matter what you do with these bullets. You know, as soon as they see it, that's it, it's forgotten. She could do anything she wants with that. And anyway, things happen. I think her brother takes the gun and shoots somebody with it. The police show up, he's going to get him. And then all of a sudden they call it in. And say, that's it. It never happened. They leave. And there's more to it than that. But that's really neat. And reading some of the other trades, different people are showing up. And they've passed these guns out to a few different people. And I can tell the tapestry there, it's two men dealing with this. It seems like they're at odds with each other. And I guess they keep talking about, the Minutemen. But it's some other crime family that they're trying to take down. But that's as far as I know. I'm going to get them all. It's really good.
So there's how many? There's 10 volumes?
13.
Okay, so this series is already already done.
Yeah, it's finished. These two men did a... Remember those Wednesdays comics? The big newspaper strips?
Yeah, Wednesdays comics,
yeah. They did the Batman strip. It was at the very beginning.
Okay.
And, which is nice. So I don't know if they're doing other work. It seems like they're kind of a team. But yeah, it's really good. I recommend it. Didn't really build it up too much. But
so what do you give the art? What rating do you give the art?
I guess I give both the art and the story a 7.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, when I say that, it's really good. I like it. He's a good artist. His style is really good. He's one of those types that can draw anything. There's a story with tigers in it, and he pulled them off. He draws cars well. He reminds me a bit of Frank Miller. I mean, if you saw it, you wouldn't think Frank Miller. But it reminds me if he was crossed between Frank Miller and Mike Mignola with more detail. It'd be this guy. He has a strong design sense, but he can draw anything. But I love how he puts things together, how the story flows, and how he lays it out. He's actually really unique. But and the story, it, to me, is just as strong as the artwork.
Well, good.
That's something I've told my daughter, and sometimes we kind of get an argument over it when she was younger, was you'd read about Japanese cartoons and series. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that's it. Whereas here, like, say, television sitcoms, they start a sitcom, hope it does well, and if it does, it goes on forever. And I don't know, sometimes it just, the show reaches its prime, past its prime, and you're just thinking they need to take it off the air. Happy Days is one of them.
Jumping the Shark, I think it's called.
Yeah, My Three Sons was another one. You know, when I grew up, people watched My Three Sons, but I didn't really understand why it was such a big show, you know. And then I started seeing some of the old black and white episodes. Really, really good. But from what I understand, Japanese television, usually the show's on for a year, and then it finishes and wraps up. The Prince Planet cartoon, it had an ending to it. They say that's just how Japanese television works. And, you know, the comics, I guess the series go on and on. I think Dragon Ball Z's gone on forever. But usually they do have an end in mind, whereas in American comics, that's kind of rare. Which, I'm not complaining. I like it when books I like go on. But anyway, 100 Bullets, had a beginning, a middle, and I've never read it yet, but it does have an end.
Cool.
So, but anyway, that's I got. What have you been reading?
Well, since it was in the Halloween mood, I just picked up an old issue of Vampirella. I figured, well, if I'm going to read something, let me read this one. And it's actually a pretty good issue. It's issue 27 from September of 1973. What's funny is I found that I had, I just found another copy I had of it, but this one, the original one that I was reading, is really beat up. I actually had to put some glue and tape it back together. But it is a really good book, and it basically starts off with a nice Esteban Moroto story called Wolf Hunt, about a wolf woman who's captured by an old guy and brought to the castle. And of course, it has the usual twist ending, but the art's really, really good. And Moroto's one of the best of the Spanish artists, even though, as me and Don have talked before, he does swipe a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But he does a really good job.
Well, he had a style I really liked. He was smooth, but very stylized. And the reason we were talking about it was I did buy, it was a Warren publication in the 80s. And it was, I guess, five stories, and they were all drawn by Esteban Moroto. I really enjoyed it. But there was one that had basically an ancient city. And I saw that same one in Richard Valamonte's Beowulf for DC Comics?
Yeah, Ricardo Villamonte.
Oh, okay, yeah, I loved him. And I mean, it was the same city, exactly. It wasn't modified or anything. I thought, what? And then somebody said, oh, yeah, he's known for stealing from people. And so, you know, but he did it really well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this story now, and I'm like, just trying to piece together where'd this figure come from, or whatever. A lot of it looks like it's photography, models and photography, but yeah, backgrounds and stuff like that. There's no doubt, but he does such a good job.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, some people would steal, and it wouldn't look right. When he did it, it looked really nice. So.
So you gotta give him props for that.
Yeah, I mean, he was a good artist.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, the second story here, Welcome to the Witch's Covenant, is kind of an interesting story because, this is from 73, and it's about a woman who's kind of got in a crappy marriage, and she decides to join her friends in a witch's coven, and the way it turns out, the witch's coven is pretty much worse than her marriage. it's almost kind of an anti-feminist thing or whatever. I don't know. It was written by Don McGregor, who went on to do a lot of things for Marvel. So it's an interesting story for its time. Let's see. The third story, called Quivering Shadows, is by Jose Bea, who I think is a good artist. My friend James does not like this guy's work. Every time I mention his name, he goes like, he makes a foul noise or whatever, but it's an interesting story about a serial killer and a gothic cat. It's kind of hard to follow, actually, but it's got a nice ending, so it's pretty good. And let's see, third story is by Bill Dubay, who ended up being the editor for Warren for a little while, and it's kind of like a jokey story about a frog, a talking frog, and the girl who kisses him, and, you know, of course, the obligatory ending. Let's see, we got a Vampirella story here by Jose Gonzalez, who's one of the better artists, and, again, talking to my friend, I found out he died last year. It was kind of sad, because I don't think he was that old, but, you know, the Vampirella is quite different in the old Warren magazine, differently from all the rest of the stories. It was an ongoing series, so this is just part of the storyline, and around this time, in the mid-70s, Warren was putting in one-color stories, so this one's in color, and it's real nice. I'm thinking the colors might have been by Richard Corbin or somebody like that. I don't know. They're not really credited, but it's very nice. Next story is by Nick Cuddy, which we talked about a mermaid, with art by Felix Moss, who's another Spanish guy, artist from same studio. It's different from the Morota, but it's very stylized, and it's very nice, actually. And then we got a real good one here by Jeff Jones. And Jones had started off doing work for Creepy in the late 60s, and his style hadn't really developed yet, but by the time of this story called Quest, it was pretty developed already. It had gotten a lot. His figure work was nicer, the design work was nicer, and what's interesting about this story is it's drawn in two, every page is just two panels. So it's kind of neat. It's kind of got that flavor of Idyll, kind of, sort of. Because I think about around this time he probably started doing Idyll, maybe a year later or something like that. But it's about an Indian searching for a woman. And again, I'm not going to tell you the ending. And then the last but not least, because this is probably the nicest one of them all, is a Wally Wood Sword and Sorcery story. And, you know, Wood was one of the all-timers, so this one's called War of the Wizards, and it's story and art by Wally Wood, but it's beautiful. It's got, I mean, just the first page, it's got some a nude woman tied to a log, and like the wizard and the warriors and all that stuff. Pure 70s sword and sorcery stuff with Wood, you know, at his peak around this time. And you got dragons and wizards and all that, so yeah, another great one. So, all in all, this is a pretty damn good issue of Vampirella. From what I understand, this was a reprint issue, because on the bottom it says featuring the all-time greatest stories. I don't know if they were the all-time greatest stories at that point for Vampirella, but I give the book, like, the art, I got to give it like a 9, because it's really got some nice art, and the story's like a 5. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. You know, most of them are interesting. But, yeah, this is a prime example. I mean, 73 Warren at his peak, pretty much. That's when they, that's when a lot of the, I think Archie Goodwin was editing at this time again. I'll have to, no, William Dubay. But Goodwin came back about a year later, and, you know, a lot of the artists were coming back. Williamson was doing stories for him. Severin came back, Russ Heath. Mm. Jones was doing stuff. Wrightson started around this time. So this was like their, you know, the original golden era was in the beginning from 65 to 67. Then it kind of like, you know, reprints and stuff started to happen. But by 73, that's their second, you know, really good era. So, yeah, all in all, a really good book.
Very nice. Excuse me.
All right, man.
Well, yeah, we've talked quite a bit. Guess that's about it.
I think we're done.
Keep thinking what you said about this issue you read. You had to glue it back together. Al and I went to some store up in Tarpon Springs. We were going through their, they had a quarter box. And he pulled out two books. You ever read this? No, one was a Batman family. I guess Alex Toth did the front story. And it only has about the bottom third of the cover. The rest of it's ripped off. And then you found the Richie Rich comic. Hey, you like these? And I bought it, and the cover was ripped off same way. And I bought them.
Yeah,
you can still read them.
You can still. This is in one piece. It just was the spine was coming off, and it looks like it got waterlogged on the back. But you know what? You can still read it, and I love it. So I went with the old. With the old Elmer's glue, and I put it back together again, so it's all good.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you can still read them even if they're coming apart.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, I like to say we'll all be back next time, but you never know. It's basically podcast roulette with us.
Hopefully Dallas's technical issues will be solved, and we'll all be back together again soon.
Anyway, so everybody have a good week, and we'll talk to you later.
And yeah, read more comics, by the way.
Always.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to our first annual Halloween episode. If you enjoyed it, tell your friends. You can check us out on our blog. It's twodimensionpodcast.blogspot.com. And below the show notes, go ahead and leave us a... a message, and we'll definitely get back to you. You can also find us on Facebook under Two Dimension Podcast. And until next time, happy Halloween, and read more comics.